From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Russian President Vladimir Putin says his country has approved a coronavirus vaccine and will vaccinate tens of thousands of people, including healthcare workers, this month. And he says one of his own daughters has already taken a dose. Naora Barzev is a professor and vaccine specialist at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. He joins us now. Professor Naor, your thoughts when you heard this pretty stunning announcement today?
Yeah, it is pretty stunning. Look, it's good news in the sense that we want more than one winner here. This isn't really a race to the finish line. We all have to get there together. You know, and many companies are manufacturing doses at high volume at risk without knowing yet the results. I guess the concerning thing, though, is the plan to roll out the vaccine for widespread use concurrently with the beginning of phase three trials is a little bit putting the cart before the horse. And usually the process would be that a vaccine demonstrate that it actually works in the phase three trials. The phase three is the pudding where the proof is. And only then regulatory bodies review the data and approve it for more widespread use.
Well, more than surprising to some, it's worrisome, because what about things like after effects? I mean, don't you need to spend a little bit of time afterwards to see if there's something, downstream that hadn't been anticipated from a vaccine?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. There's evidence that's amassing all along the way in vaccine development of safety. But the proof of safety really depends not just on phase three, but even beyond phase three. So there are examples in the past where vaccines were approved for use without phase three results. That happened in some places with the meningococcal C vaccine, for example. But there are special situations where that happens. For example, we need very strong correlate of protection. In other words, we need to know precisely the degree to which generating immunity relates to actual disease protection. We don't know any of that for coronavirus. And the outcome has to be relatively rare, which would make it impossible to do large-scale phase three trials. But again, that's not true for coronavirus. So this is a shortcut, really, that the Russians are announcing, and it's an unsafe shortcut. And even once a vaccine is approved and rolled out and is in wide use, still there needs to be safety surveillance. So I would hope, at least, that even if approval occurs in Russia, that safety surveillance isn't compromised in that way. But it is a bit of an unusual decision to approve use before we even know that it works.
Well, China has also authorized a vaccine to use on its military. That's disturbing to people for the reasons you just listed. Is there any reason you can think of, as someone who's an expert in vaccines, that this could be so much sooner than the vaccine that could be rolled out at the earliest, maybe after the new year in the U.S.? And even that's said to be wishful thinking. Is there a reason why this might have come faster?
Well, it's difficult for me to second guess the thinking in the Russian regulatory bodies, but I guess it's very important to say that vaccine development and deployment really cannot be politicized. One worries about regulatory bodies. They have such an important role and they have to remain independent. And so it is worrying if there's a suggestion that there are political pressures that they're under, perhaps financial pressures that companies and regulatory bodies might be under. So it's very important that the independence of regulatory bodies is maintained.
Just briefly, Professor, because we do hope that there is a vaccine sooner rather than later. But again, a safe one, because there are people who have been ginning up a fear of vaccines, as you know, in this pandemic, tying it to questions about masks and distancing and other things. There have been a lot of anti-vaxxers already saying, the vaccines are unsafe. So there's even more reason to want it to be safe. As an historian of this, are there other times in history where a vaccine, before it worked, has not worked?
Look, the issue of hesitancy is a really crucial one. No vaccine, even a perfect vaccine, it won't work if people don't take it. And the way, or one of the key ways of reassuring the public, is that we're completely transparent and open about the process of safety evaluation. Because it's not either or. A vaccine could still work, but still cause rare issues. And then it's really a question of weighing up the pros and cons in each given context. So the classical example of that was the Rotashield vaccine, a vaccine against diarrheal disease in children. It was very effective, but it caused rare, serious adverse events. It was removed from the market. It was removed from use within a year of its licensure. And then for almost 10 years, we didn't have another vaccine for that diarrheal disease, rotavirus. Hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of children in the rest of the world died of diarrheal disease, and they were preventable deaths. So there's a balance to be had between the adverse events and the risks and the benefits of the vaccine. And that balance is not a universal thing. It's so complex ethical issues that need to be debated publicly. But again, to do that, you need transparency. You need to share the data with the general public. Ethics is not the remit of scientists alone. We provide facts, and then society has to debate those facts and their meaning and how they would make policy on the basis of those facts.
Nahra Barzev, professor and vaccine specialist at Johns Hopkins University. Professor Barzev, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Lebanon marked a moment of silence today, 1 week after that massive explosion in Beirut. The blast killed more than 160 people and injured thousands more. It's also brought down the current government. Rami Khoury is a senior fellow and professor of journalism at the American University in Beirut. And Rami, a prime minister and the entire cabinet resigning seems significant. But do you think this will lead to real reform in Lebanon, the kind of change that protesters are asking for?
The resignation of the cabinet is significant only in the sense that it was forced by the demonstrations, the intensity of the demonstrations. It's not significant in the modern history of Lebanon because the ruling elite who head their sectarian parties and who have run the country like an oligarchic clique for the last 25 years, they just get together and pick out new cabinet ministers, a new prime minister, and they reappoint the cabinet, and the same policies tend to continue. That's been the pattern so far. This is what the protesters want to break. They want to break this pattern and put in a proper, effective, clean, efficient, and accountable government that works according to the rule of law and can address the many problems of a country that is in collapse. So it's significant at one level, but at another level it's not, and it'll depend on what happens next.
That system that you're talking about, that power-sharing structure, that clique, as you called it, has been blamed for the country's past political instability and division. So what happens now? Will there be new elections, and will those elections be enough?
You're going to get a lot of jockeying for position and jockeying for power and a lot of nonsense being spoken by a lot of people. The bottom line is there's only two real powers in the country now. One is the mass of citizens who are protesting and who demand real change. So the protesters on one hand, and then the political power elite, the sectarian leaders, mainly Hezbollah, on the other hand, will negotiate. The protesters want significant real change. This is what really we have to keep our eye on. Will the government that's formed, whoever it is, will it have the real authority to address the real crisis issues? And we'll find that out, I think, in the coming month or two.
You know, Lebanon has a long history of political unrest that dates back decades. And you mentioned the people there. They've been living it. They know it. But I want to ask you about some touch points that may have led to this point. I mean, many people know that thousands of people died in a brutal civil war in Lebanon between 75 and 1990. I mean, did the agreement that ended that war set the stage in a way for what's happening today?
The ending of the war was simply the latest turning point that adjusted the balance of power in the parliament and made it 50% Christian, 50% Muslim. But these are just minor points, really, compared to the bigger points, which is that the people who've actually been in the seats of power have been terrible rulers, and they've essentially become super rich without addressing the needs of the people, as the people have become super poor. But the root cause, it's both domestic politics, regional politics, which is mostly Israel and Iran and Syria and Saudi Arabia and other people who interfere in Lebanon, and global politics back in the Cold War.
You know, many experts are saying the best case scenario for moving forward is to have an independent prime minister to be named who would undertake these economic reforms and put together all of what you're talking about, an economic and financial rescue plan. You talk about how Hezbollah kind of plays a role in the background, kind of shifting alliances, and they have a lot of power. Is that the best case scenario for you at this moment, that this would likely happen, that there would be an independent prime minister named?
Well, there's no such thing as an independent prime minister. You'd have to have a credible prime minister who has the authority, which is conferred on him by the political power structure, My guess is there's going to be a compromise to name a credible prime minister who can appoint credible ministers, technocrats, and a transitional emergency government that can address the really, really urgent things like start the economy again. Hezbollah, more than anybody, needs a functioning Lebanese state. Hezbollah does not want to run the country. They could if they wanted to take over the country, but that's the last thing they want to do. They want to just do what they feel is their role, which is they define as resistance against repeated Israeli incursions and attacks, and Western American, European, other hegemonic aims, as they call them. And they don't want to be responsible for running the Lebanese state. They understand that you've got to have some minimum amount of credibility and legitimacy with your own people. It doesn't matter if the Iranians or the Saudis or the Americans or somebody else out there loves you and gives you money. What matters is you've got to have the credibility of your own people. And Lebanese governments in recent years haven't had that.
That's Rami Khoury. He is a senior fellow and professor of journalism at the American University of Beirut. Rami, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Do you know where your wine comes from? What about your beer or liquor? These industries bring in billions of dollars in revenue each year and are almost exclusively white-dominated industries. Today, we talk with two entrepreneurs who have broken through, Jackie Summers and Shay Frechette, both of whom represent the 1% of black wine and liquor makers. Shay is part owner of Frechette Winery in Washington State's Red Mountain, and Jackie is the creator of Sorrel Liquor. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Tanya. I'm happy to be here.
Good to see you both.
Jackie, I want to start with you. So I've read that you said everyone in the Caribbean has their own version of a drink called Sorrel. But back in 2011, you became the first black person in the United States to hold a license to make it. It was a health scare that made you take this step. Can you tell us more?
I will keep the story as brief as possible. In 2010, I had a cancer scare. My doctor found a tumor the size of a golf ball inside my spine. And he said, you have a 95% chance of death and a 50% chance of partial paralysis if you live. The short version is I lived, but it will absolutely make you reconsider what you want to do with your life. And Tanya, the thing I wanted to do with my life was day drink. I want to be around cool people, talking about things that matter, having good food and conversation and good alcohol, and I wanted to monetize it. It's colloquially called Sorrel. Every Caribbean family makes their own version. Everyone thinks theirs is the best. I thought mine was the best. What I did not know and what I could not have known at the time was when I got my license to make liquor, I was the only black person in America at the time to hold that license.
And I want to get to some of those systemic problems at play that make it so hard for people of color to get into this industry. But Shay, let's talk a little bit about your story. You opened your winery 7 years ago. Since then, you've grown to 5 acres of land into a full-fledged winery, and you produce about 2,000 cases of wine a year. You're the only black woman winemaker in the state of Washington. Why are you the only? And what are some of the challenges that you faced?
Gosh, you know, so I'm the only black female wine who owns a winery in the state of Washington. And, you know, I ask myself that question a lot just because just like Jackie, I knew that I hadn't seen many black women making wine or owning wine brands. But in a lot of ways, I think that it was just like a boys club, and there were barriers because you know, it may have been a little more challenging, you know, to really get started if you didn't have someone that really knew you and was, you know, really open to creating that relationship. I am thrilled to see that there are more black women and black men who are seeing that there are opportunities to join, you know, Jackie and me in this industry.
Yeah, you mentioned that it's a boys club. Jackie, you've written that you watch over and over again who gets funded, who gets bank loans. And this is one of the biggest barriers of entry for people of color. Can you say more?
Well, first, I want to give props to our girl for having to take the double hit of racism and misogyny. Because the only thing harder than being a black person in this country is being a Black woman. And I have to acknowledge so much credit for you to overcoming whatever you've had to go through to get to this part.
Well, but thank you, Jack.
To answer the question, the entry to market is designed to be almost impenetrable. And unless you have extraordinary resources or extraordinary willpower, you don't ever see people like us doing these things.
You were able to break through and you have this successful brand, but are you fearful of this idea of exceptionalism? I mean, both of you are really the onlys, and you'd like to see a pathway for more representation. Shay, what solutions would you like to see implemented to bring more people of color into these industries?
You know, I think an easy way is for the brands that are already seeing that they have a Black audience to start using those faces in their marketing and advertising. And I say that because just yesterday I had someone in my tasting room and I'm welcoming them and I'm talking about the wines. And one of the folks in that party just says, oh, like, what do you do? Assist the winemaker here?
I can't tell you how many times I've shown up with my brand and people have said, oh, deliveries are in the back. I'm not doing deliveries. I own the brand.
And and that has been common. And I feel like sometimes, you know, I can't help but feel like sometimes that is a barrier that for me, when folks see me at a trade event pouring a wine, it's well, maybe she works for that brand, but if she represents that brand, I don't know if I want to bring that brand in. But I think with companies now, specifically in wine, what I'm seeing is brands, at least in my area, starting to take a hard look at the way that they've been doing business.
Jackie, what do you think about what Shay is saying, though, about marketing? Because you actually say that alcohol culture in general owes everything to Black people. What do you mean by that? And how might that inform possibly getting more people into this industry?
Well, first, I want to touch on the point about exceptionalism. Is that okay?
Oh, yeah, let's do it. Yes, yes.
So my dad was a pianist for Louis Armstrong in the 1940s. Over the course of 40 years, he played with Armstrong, Ellington, Billy. He played with all the jazz greats, but he would not think of what he did as exceptional. He was trying to eat and feed a family. So I think that there are lots and lots of people like Shay, like myself, who are doing the thing that we do because there's no other standard but exceptional. But part of the problem is, again, there's systemic barriers to entry. The alcohol industry in this country owes everything to Black people. A slave taught Jack Daniels how to make whiskey. So much is owed to us, and we own so little of it. And I want to see more of us own things.
Has anything changed, though, since you all got into the industry? I'm thinking about you, Jackie. You know, it was big headlines when you got your license to make Sorrel. Have you seen more people of color enter the industry? Have you been able to do all of the things that you're talking about?
So I got to tell you, it was actually really little headlines. It only became big headlines about 2 months ago. We only recently got this international Black Lives Matter movement, and suddenly everyone agrees that, yes, racism is real, and now it's a story.
So I guess I would ask, do you think this moment then of what many people are calling racial reckoning is a moment to actually correct the wrongs that have been happening for so long and maybe open up some of those doors in the way of finances, in the way of mentorship? Are you hopeful for that, Shay?
I'm hopeful, but I'm also looking at this as, you know, there's some fire right now, and I'd love to see the fire that's burning now continue. But then I do turn that back on me in, you know, what is it that that I should be doing? How do I still show my face? How do I still do my best to open doors for the next Black woman who wants to get into this industry? How can I help be a voice for her? I want to ask myself those same questions and make sure that I'm being held accountable too.
I mean, you've really answered this, Jackie, but I want to be more pointed. Why is representation important in these industries?
So there's a joke I tell when I give my seminar. I ask my audience, who has seen a lion in person? Who's seen a tiger? Who's seen a bear? And then I ask, who's seen a black liquor brand owner in person? And the room goes dead silent. It is more likely that people have been in the physical presence of lions and tigers and bears than in the presence of a black liquor brand owner. So part of it is just acclimating people to the idea, I am more than the laborer. I am more than the factory worker. I am the idea. I am the concept. And at the end of the day, I'm the person that says yes or no. So if you don't know how to deal with me, you have to adjust. Shay's absolutely right. We are at the moment, we're at a moment in time where there is ebb, where there's flow. And the flow is in our favor. And I want for people who look back in 50 years on the uprising of 2020 to know, back then we made changes that they can stand on to.
That's Jackie Summers. He's the creator of Sorrel Liquor. And Shay Frechette, she is a black winemaker and part owner of Frechette Winery in Washington State's Red Mountain. Thank you both for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
That was powerful. Yeah. Thank you so much, Tanya and Jackie. Wow. What a treat to have spent some time with you here.
I can't wait to come out to Washington and taste your wines once travel is a thing again.
Can't wait to have you.
One in five college campuses is planning to reopen, primarily in person for the fall semester, and some are counting on widespread COVID-19 testing to help clamp down on potential outbreaks. Side Effects Public Media's Christine Herman has a look at the testing program at one state university.
Large white tents have been popping up across the University of Illinois campus lately. On a sunny summer day in Urbana, graduate student Kristen Munoz approaches a table in one of those tents. She presents her ID and gets a plastic tube. Then she walks to a spot marked on the ground and collects her saliva in the tube.
This seems to be a lot easier than sticking a cotton swab up your nose.
In just a few hours, she gets the results, negative. University of Illinois chemist Martin Burke is one of the researchers who developed the test being used here. They're still calculating the cost, but he says it's much lower than standard tests. And by doing both sample collection and analysis on site, the university avoids the backlog seen at many public health and commercial labs. The plan is to offer free tests to all of the 50,000 students returning this fall, plus about 11,000 university employees.
The exciting thing is because we can test up to 10,000 per day, it allows the scientists to do what's really the best for trying to protect the community as opposed to having to cut corners because of the limitations of the testing.
Research is still preliminary, but the campus's own studies and early results from other labs show spit tests are as accurate, if not more so, than nasal swab tests. Around the U.S., some campuses reopening for the fall have announced similar testing programs, but many others are limiting tests to those with symptoms or known exposure to someone with COVID-19. Epidemiologist Becky Smith of the University of Illinois says mandatory twice-a-week testing will be enforced for anyone participating in campus life. She says that's because when a person gets infected, a detectable amount of virus doesn't show up in their system for 3 or 4 days.
But about 2 days after that, your infectiousness peaks. So we have a very small window of time in which to catch people before they have done most of the infection that they're going to be doing.
David Paul Thiel is a professor of public health policy at Yale, whose research helped inform the approach at Illinois. He says mask wearing and social distancing are important, but those measures must be coupled with retesting everyone every few days.
I am painfully aware of the fact that this sets a very high bar that may very well be beyond the capacity of many universities and their students in their care.
Still, the consequences of an outbreak, he says, are severe, and those harmed will be the most vulnerable on campus and in the community. Paltiel disagrees with CDC guidance for higher ed institutions, which says there's not enough data to know if testing everyone reentering campus is effective. The COVID-19 plan on Yale's website says all students will be tested upon arrival and will be required to retest twice a week throughout the semester. Meanwhile, Becky Smith of the University of Illinois says she's been contacted by other schools wanting to adopt a similar program.
Everything that we are doing, we are documenting and we are sharing with any university who contacts us.
While the Urbana Campus Lab has been certified to use the tests, researchers are still working on getting FDA clearance for other labs to adopt it. For Here and Now, I'm Christine Herman.
We're used to big sounds and big thoughts from jazz musician Maria Schneider with her Maria Schneider Orchestra. She's created pieces like the Grammy-winning Cerulean Skies, which took bird sounds and incorporated them into a large, lush work reflecting her middle-of-the-country roots. But Maria Schneider's new release has even broader scope. Data Lords is a double album that takes on both the digital and natural world as subjects, one CD each. Here's the title track. Data Lords by the Maria Schneider Orchestra and other places on the double album. She returns to something more familiar, an almost reverential homage to the nature poetry of Ted Kooser. What are we saying here? Maria Schneider joins us now by Skype with more. Maria, so good to speak with you again.
It's great to speak with you too.
You know, it feels to me like this album is somehow made for this moment because we all are really having to confront the digital world in ways many people didn't have to depend on it before. If you're working from home, yearning for nature, you know, this collision is kind of in the moment, even though you started the project before it. What made you think of it?
Well, I think as a musician, this is an issue that confronted my life and the lives of everybody in the creative community, filmmakers and everything, as we started to see our work shared for free. And we all became pretty early on, or at least I did, aware that what this was really about was using creative work as a carrot for gathering data by big data companies. And it took us, I think, a long time to understand as a society, and I think most people don't, how powerful that data is. And that it's not a small thing for us to trade free products for information from our private lives that can be used against us.
Which is why the cut Data Lords sounds so ominous, you know? But let's listen to a little of the first track of the digital world. This is called A World Lost. You said in the liner notes that this is kind of about kids being wrapped up in their devices, losing touch with the ability to look out a window. Again, with kids having to stay at home in so many places, this really resonates.
I think so. What I know about myself, and I remember when somebody first introduced me to email, they said, oh, you have to get email. And I remember when I wrote this person back, and as I thought about, oh, let me rewrite that sentence and do this or that, I thought, oh my God, this is going to suck the life out of my life if suddenly I have to communicate on this level with Lord knows how many people. And as a creative person,
what is really important to me and just as a human is that silent space, even when it's uncomfortable. And I know as a kid, a lot of times I felt bored. I think in the liner notes I talk about looking out the window or, you know, or sometimes just feeling horribly bored. And then we would go outside and we would start making things with stuff we found or whatever. And suddenly the world would become big and it would be full of creative ideas and things we dreamed of making and building. And I think that we are losing that expanse in our own lives. I think children are losing it, and I think adults are losing it. Mm.
It sounds like you're feeling something that a lot of people are feeling now, that we are trapped even more with our technology, again, in this moment than ever before. And so I'm going to stay with this first album, which is, again, about the Data Lords, the technology CD. This cut is called Don't Be Evil, of course, Google's motto. Let's listen. I'm picturing big fat cat Silicon Valley executives. What are you saying here?
Well, it's mocking them, and it's mocking that aspirational motto, don't be evil. And you can't set the bar lower than don't be evil. And I feel that they haven't even managed to make it to that low bar, even.
This is so interesting because, again, you wrote all of this music before the moment that we're in right now when people are boycotting Facebook because of the way it spreads hate speech. You seem to be on to something in the digital world, which is, again, the one of two albums in your new release, The Data Lords. And then there's Our Natural World, the second album. Let's have a little taste. This is Bluebird. What are you saying here?
Well, the second side of this album, all of this, I'll start by just saying, came quite naturally. The music just came out of me, and what the music was showing me is this polarization that I am struggling with in my own life. To stay connected to the natural world sometimes means, you know what, I'm just going to leave my phone at home. And making that decision and then reconnecting. When I turn those devices off and I make that decision to have that space, then I find myself reconnecting to all those beautiful things, poetry, art, nature, just, you know, that expansive world that is full of questions and unknowns and inspiration and art, you know. So this, the pieces on that side of the album are all coming out of those things that are most important to me.
Yeah. There's another piece that just, it's like a prayer that, I didn't mean to invoke Madonna, you know, it really, it's like a real prayer. It takes its title from the poem March 20th by the poet Ted Kooser. Let's listen.
I can say it. I know it. It must be to someone that I am alive and walking and that I have written these poems. This morning, the sun stood right at the end of the road and waited for me.
Ooh.
Yeah. To me, it's an affirmation that this world, this life, the sun, good things are at the end of that road and they're waiting for us. If we look up, if we have our eyes up and looking to each other and within ourselves to connect to ourselves and what's important to ourselves, to our world, and to each other. It's my hopeful message at the end of the album.
That's Grammy-winning jazz composer and orchestra director Maria Schneider. Her new double album with the Maria Schneider Orchestra is called Data Lords. And by the way, one way you can use the internet in, you know, a good and healthy way is to contribute to artists like her through the crowdfunding site ArtistShare. We'll hook you up at hereandnow.org. Maria, thank you so much.
Thank you.
A U-turn for two major ride-hailing companies, Uber and Lyft. A judge in San Francisco ordered yesterday that both companies classify drivers as employees instead of independent contractors. Uber and Lyft have argued their drivers prefer the flexibility of working as freelancers, while labor unions contend the independent classification deprives drivers of benefits like health insurance and workers' compensation. Let's talk more about this with Ina Free, chief technology correspondent for Axios. Hi, Ina.
Thanks, Tanya.
So California is the biggest market in the U.S. for both of these companies. It's actually where they were both founded. Drivers have been outspoken about pay and rights for a really long time, and this pandemic has exacerbated this issue as demand for services has gone down. Tell us why this injunction is significant.
Well, it's significant because all the past efforts have really resulted in a standoff where the companies were under pressure to add benefits, but not being forced to. And this ruling, unless an appeals court stays it, would actually force them to immediately make that change. The ruling would go in effect in 10 days unless an appeals court takes it up.
To step back a few steps, this lawsuit in May filed by the California Attorney General and several city attorneys contend that Uber and Lyft violated a new law known as AB 5, which went into effect at the beginning of the year, by misclassifying drivers as independent contractors versus employees. Uber and Lyft contend they actually made some adjustments after the law went into effect. Why did those changes fall short?
Well, the changes were designed to get around this law, and they made a couple superficial changes that impacted riders some, but didn't really change the fundamental nature of the service.
Uber's CEO is actually calling for establishing benefit funds for gig workers instead of this overhaul of classifying them as employees. Can you tell us a little bit about what he's proposing?
Well, what Uber would like to see is a different sort of system. And in part, that's recognizing that they weren't going to be able to get away with the way that they've done things in the past. But also recognizing that offering traditional benefits in the way that typically companies have may not be super workable for either the company or workers. Workers who, you know, in many cases want to be able to have the flexibility to drive an hour or two one week and nearly full time another week. So what Uber proposed in an op-ed in the New York Times is a third system, a third way, something that's not an employee and not a contractor.
Okay. What's the response to that idea and also to this ruling from drivers and labor advocates?
So, I mean, labor advocates want to see them classified as employees and have been pushing hard. I think, you know, it's hard to know. You know, drivers don't speak with one unified voice here because
yes.
People drive for Uber and Lyft for different reasons. For some people, it's their main job, and they clearly would benefit from benefits, assuming they still had the same amount of hours, et cetera. Others do it sporadically, do it as an augment to their regular job, and benefits might be less important.
Mm-hmm. Uber and Lyft have 10 days to appeal this decision before it goes into effect, and both have said that they plan to. But in light of what has happened over the last year and really several years, what's their argument?
Well, I think, you know, their point is they're not exactly employees. They do have more flexibility than your typical employee, similar to contractors. You know, they really are somewhere in between the two if you look at what tends to characterize an employee or a contractor, although the California law was specifically designed to say, no, these are employees. There are also ballot measures coming up in California that could change California law, even this newly created California law that was the resulted in this injunction.
Okay. So there will be lots of shifts and changes over the next few months. I want to know, how do you think this will impact the future of the gig economy? Could other states follow suit in more stringent enforcement of labor rights for workers in the gig economy?
I think we may see more efforts for states. I think it's also really a reminder of how unique the American system is, where people rely on their job to provide health care. It's another area where, you know, having health care provided by the state, by the government, instead of the workforce would make life dramatically simpler and more straightforward. It's another reason for universal health care, if you will, is if more of our economy is going to look like the gig economy, traditional employer-based benefits seem to make less and less sense.
That's Ina Fried, Chief Technology Correspondent for Axios. Thank you, Ina.
Thank you.
Are you an Uber or Lyft driver? Do you work in the gig economy? Tell us what you think of this order at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young.